Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, November 19th, 2005. Today, we look towards the upcoming holidays. We'll give you a holiday commentary by Tom Jackson, as well as Tom's coverage of last year's Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Mass. We'll also have updates from the School of the Americas Watch, which is currently holding its annual convergence at the school this weekend. We'll also bring you music, information of other sorts, including announcements, and Between the Lines will be our last segment. Stay tuned. First, we bring you news with Steve Diamond.
This is Steve Diamond with some news you may have missed from this last week. Although this first story we hope you've all heard by now already. Previously pro-war Democrat calls for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, from the Associated Press. Raising the temperature in Congress over U.S. policy in Iraq, a pro-military Democrat who once voted to back the war now says it is time to bring the troops home. On Thursday, Representative John Murtha said, "Our troops have become the primary target of the insurgency. They are united against U.S. forces, and we have become a catalyst for violence. The war in Iraq is not going as advertised. It is a flawed policy wrapped in illusion." As a Vietnam veteran and top Democrat on the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, with close ties to many military officers, the 30-year Pennsylvania lawmaker carries more credibility with his colleagues on the issue than a number of other Democrats who have opposed the war from the start. Referring to President Bush, John Murtha said, "I resent the fact, on Veterans Day, he criticized Democrats for criticizing them." The GOP-controlled Senate on Tuesday defeated a Democratic push for Bush to lay out a timetable for withdrawal. Spotlighting mushrooming questions from both parties about the war, though, the chamber then approved a statement that 2006 should be a significant year in which conditions are created for the phased withdrawal of U.S. forces. Murtha estimated that all U.S. troops could be pulled out within 6 months. He introduced a resolution Thursday that would force the president to call back the military, but it was unclear when or if either GOP-run chamber of Congress would vote on it. Murtha's shift from an earlier war backer to a critic advocating withdrawal reflects plummeting public support for a war that has cost more than $200 billion and led to the deaths of more than 2,000 U.S. troops. And here's some more about the U.S. war on Iraq from the Financial Times website, FT.com. Phosphorus may have killed in Iraq. The U.S. military on Wednesday acknowledged it might have killed civilians in the Iraqi city of Fallujah with white phosphorus munitions during the battle against insurgents a year ago. The Pentagon insisted civilians had not been targeted, however, and that it had avoided unnecessary casualties by evacuating the city before the offensive. White phosphorus, which is fired by artillery or mortars, can be used as an incendiary device or to create a smokescreen. While it is not classified as a chemical weapon, the chemical is covered by Protocol 3 of the 1980 Convention on Conventional Weapons, which prohibits the use of incendiary weapons against military forces located within concentrations of civilians, as was the case in Fallujah. The U.S. is party to the convention, but, unlike a number of its allies, including the U.K., it has not signed Protocol 3. Last week, Italy's RAI 24 news channel broadcast a documentary that alleged many civilians had been burned to death by the incendiary devices during the assault. It showed bodies burned to the bone inside clothes that remained intact. That admission by the U.S. military contradicts earlier statements they made, claiming that white phosphorus was used only for illumination flares. And next, from the Boston Globe. Students rebuffing military recruiters. More high schoolers in state opt out of lists. More than 5,000 high school students in five of the state's largest school districts have removed their names from military recruitment lists, a trend driven by continuing casualties in Iraq and a well-organized peace movement that has urged students to avoid contact with recruiters. The number of students removing their names has jumped significantly over the past year, especially in school systems with many low-income and minority students, where parents and activists are growing increasingly assertive in challenging military recruiters' access to young people. Since 2002, under the federal No Child Left Behind law, high schools have been required to provide lists of students' names, telephone numbers, and addresses to military recruiters who ask for them, as well as colleges and potential employers. Students who do not wish to be contacted, or their parents, notify their school districts in writing. In Boston, about 3,700 students, or 19% of those enrolled in the city's high schools, have removed their names from recruiting lists. At Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin School, more than half the student body ordered the school system not to give their names to the military this year. Overall, approximately 18% of the public high school students eligible in Cambridge, Boston, Worcester, Lowell, and Fall River have opted to remove their names. Though no official national statistics are available, a group founded 6 months ago to raise awareness of the law said visitors to its website have downloaded 37,000 copies of a form that can be used to remove students' names from the recruiting lists. "There's momentum, you can see," said Felicity Crush, spokeswoman for the San Francisco-based Leave My Child Alone project. "As soon as people become aware of it, they start to take action." Students cite the rising death toll in Iraq as a key factor for their lack of interest in the military, but also acknowledge concerns raised by their parents. Gwen Claiborne, 18, a senior at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School in Roxbury, said she had her name removed from the call list at the urging of her father, who served in the military. Ladija Ristic, 17, a senior at Cambridge Ringe in Latin, fled war-torn Serbia with her family when she was 4. Now an opponent of the war in Iraq, she said she feels urban students are especially being targeted by recruiters. In interviews, military officials downplayed the significance of the trend and said they do not track the number of students on the list from year to year. They stressed that the contact information from high schools is only one way to reach potential recruits, and there are alternatives, such as motor vehicle registration databases, college day fairs at the schools, or visits to shopping malls. One Massachusetts Army recruiting commander, however, expressed concern that school officials' increasing efforts to accommodate students who want their names omitted are causing delays in the Army obtaining the contact lists. More than 2 months into the school year, roughly one-third of the 75 public high schools in communities north of Boston have not handed over their lists yet, said Captain Mark Spear, based in Woburn. He said, "About 35% are still delinquent, and we're haggling back and forth, and they're saying the opt-out period hasn't ended. By this time of year, we would like to have the names in hand." And our final story, from the School of the Americas Watch. Woman GI publicly stands against war as she faces immediate deployment to the Middle East. From Fort Benning, Georgia, Army National Guard Specialist Catherine Jashinsky, on active duty since January of this year, will make a public statement against war as a conscientious objector in the face of orders to participate in weapons training and deploy to the Middle East. She'll be joined by several members of Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace. Jashinsky applied for a discharge as a conscientious objector in 2004. The Army recently denied her claim and ordered her to weapons training and deployment this week. Speakers at the press conference include Aydin Delgado, an Army conscientious objector and member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Delgado said, "Iraq Veterans Against the War supports the right of every soldier to follow their conscience. The war is illegal and immoral." Jashinsky's counselor, Persian Gulf War Army conscientious objector Amy Allison, stated, "As the first woman GI to publicly take a stand against this war and to declare herself a conscientious objector, Catherine's actions are very significant. She is showing remarkable courage." Jashinsky's lawyer, J.E. McNeil, with the Center for Conscience and War, comments, "Denying Catherine conscientious objector status is yet another in a long line of actions by the military to defy its own rules in order to get the number of soldiers they need to continue this war." Jashinsky's statement comes on the eve of a national demonstration at the gates of Fort Benning calling for the closure of the U.S. Army School of the Americas.
Speaking of the School of the Americas Watch, here's a press release issued November 17, 2005. Thousands to rally to demand closure of controversial U.S. Army training school this weekend. The refusal of the Bush administration to ban torture techniques, pictures of abuse at the hands of U.S. personnel, and reports about secret CIA detention facilities have catapulted the notorious School of the Americas back into the public spotlight. Thousands around the country are traveling to Columbus, Georgia, for a November 19th through 20th demonstration calling for the closure of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. A combat training facility for Latin American security personnel located at Fort Benning, Georgia, made headlines in 1996 when the Pentagon released training manuals used at the school that advocated torture, extortion, and execution. Despite this shocking admission and hundreds of documented human rights abuses connected to soldiers trained at the school, no independent investigation into the training facility has ever taken place. Graduates of the school, more than 60,000 over its 59-year history, continue to be implicated in human rights violations throughout Latin America. Critics argue that the school promotes military solutions to social and political problems. Carlos Mauricio, a Salvadoran torture survivor and human rights activist, said, "We will demonstrate both to remember the past and to demand accountability for the present. The first step towards respect for human rights is to close this school." Organizers of the event call this November's event unique in light of an upcoming congressional vote on the school. Earlier this year, Representative Jim McGovern, a Democrat from Massachusetts, introduced H.R. 1217 to suspend operations at the school and to investigate the development and use of the torture manuals. The bill currently has over 122 bipartisan co-sponsors. The annual vigil to close the SOA has grown from a dozen people in November of 1990 to more than 16,000 last year. This year's gathering will culminate on Sunday, November 20th, with a symbolic funeral procession to the gates of Fort Benning. Many will negotiate a barbed wire fence to enter the military base in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience. Since protests against the school began more than a decade ago, over 180 people have served federal prison sentences. Looking back at past protests, we bring you a report from the Atlanta, Georgia Independent Media Center about the sentencing of arrestees from the 2002 protests. It was recorded on January 31st, 2003.
From the Atlanta Independent Media Center. Nuns, teachers, vets, and students go to prison. The first half of the 85 demonstrators that crossed onto Fort Benning last November completed their trials yesterday. All 42 were found guilty of criminal trespass. Sentencing from Federal Magistrate Faircloth was severe, ranging from 12 months probation with fines and community service to 6 months in federal prison and $2,000 fines. The trials for last November's protesters at Fort Benning began earlier than usual this year. In all, 86 people are being prosecuted, 85 of whom are charged with the federal misdemeanor of criminal trespass onto Fort Benning property. One, Carl Meyer, faces city charges for refusing to be searched at the protest area checkpoint the city set up. The November 2002 demonstrations were the first to have seen these safety precautions, a line of city police with handheld metal detectors. Everyone that wished to enter the permitted protest area was subjected to these searches. Several who went through the search point gave a letter to the police stating that they did not consent to this search, nor to giving up their Fourth Amendment rights, in order to exercise their First Amendment rights. Five had their court dates earlier this year. Two of these had their charges deferred, while the remaining three pled guilty to criminal trespass. Two were sentenced to 12 months probation, the other 3 months prison. Two more were tried on the 21st of January. Jeremiah John and Charity Ryerson pled guilty to the Class B misdemeanor of destruction of federal property for cutting a lock on the Fort Benning gate and a Class A misdemeanor of criminal trespass. Their sentencing awaits an investigation. From January 27th to the 29th, 42 more of the 85 peace activists appeared before Federal Magistrate G. Mallon Faircloth. The trials took place in rounds of between 2 to 7 defendants. All defendants were found guilty of criminal trespass. Sentences ranged from 12 months probation plus community service and fine to the maximum of 6 months in federal prison and a $2,000 fine. Defendants from the first three rounds all pled guilty, while those in rounds 4 through 7 pled not guilty, but stipulated to the facts of the case as laid out by the prosecution. This essentially means that they admitted to the act of crossing onto the base, but that they felt they were doing so was not criminal. This plea also afforded the accused the opportunity to make a statement that was entered into the court record as to why they felt compelled to bring their expression of dissent onto base property. The eighth round consisted of the final two defendants. They pled not guilty and had a full trial. For more information, please go to www.atlanta.indymedia.org. That's indymedia with a Y.
I pulled up there at the gate. I'd come to keep a date with 10,000 of my friends. Here to right some wrongs and make amends. Full steaming buses, bikes and cars, with voices, fiddles and guitars. All kinds of people, shapes and styles. Burn those frequent flyer miles. First thing I see is a singing nun at the frisky age of 91. She's here fresh out of jail. Told the judge I ain't got no bail. I'm bearing witness right here and now, 'cause we've got to change the world somehow. So with you all right here I pray, we'll shut down the SOA. There's this year's crop from Oberlin. There's the folks from Warren Wilson, but they're not all 18 to 22. They brought along their neighbors too. There's grandma, baby, mom and dad, an ARA kid fighting mad. What are we gonna do today? We'll shut down the SOA. There's some in pink, some in black. There's one wrapped in a coffee sack. There's t-shirts, stickers, pins and more, saying we don't want your oil war. There's a labor lawyer from Walla Walla with some Mayan folks from Guatemala. See, north and south the people say, we'll shut down the SOA. Pouring blood, crossing lines, holding crosses, making signs. There's priests and punks and groups and pairs, along with the gang in wheelchairs. There's Josh and Abby, Bill and Sue, Charlie Tao and you know who. Giant puppets, paper mache, saying we'll shut down the SOA. Yeah, we'll keep coming to this town till this torture school's shut down. Then we'll march as we intone, you do not walk alone, to the next symbol in our sights, in the global fight for human rights. But for now we're here in this Georgia clay, saying we'll shut down the SOA.
That was the SOA song number 2 by David Rovix. We now go to Tom Jackson for a holiday commentary.
Well, the holiday season is upon us. Like many people, I have conflicting feelings dancing in my head. Here comes Thanksgiving, a day of eating, a lot. A day of telling grade schoolers about pilgrims coming to the New World and befriending Native Americans. A nice story, but distant from the reality of a genocidal taking of someone else's homeland. And what can you say about Christmas? It's a day when lots of non-Christians buy friends and family members gifts, maybe go to church, and definitely eat a lot. At the risk of sounding like Dana Carvey's church lady, I think Jesus of Nazareth might have a bit of a problem with the way we celebrate his birthday. If you disagree, please read the New Testament. Then there's New Year's Eve, a party night, followed by New Year's Day, some nursing hangovers, some watching college football bowl games on the TV, and most everyone eating a lot. Sure, there are other holidays that fall around the same time of year, like Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, and Eid. But let's face it, we're all hit every year in this country with a barrage of messages about Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. One of the most prevalent messages being, of course, buy, buy, buy. It's true there are ways we can make the holidays more meaningful, but what I want to talk about today is the idea of celebrating some alternative holidays. Here's a few ideas that happen to fall around this time of year. November 8th is Dorothy Day's birthday. Dorothy Day, co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, that started out with one community in New York City, based on faith and resistance and a desire to serve the poor. They not only provided food and clothing to the poor, they invited them to live at their house. There's Catholic worker houses and communities all across the country today, and a few in other countries. Residents take on different aspects of running the communities in an atmosphere of at least voluntary simplicity, if not voluntary poverty. If materialism, greed, war, things like that are getting you down, pay a visit to one of these communities. You'll be inspired, and you may even want to live at one. You don't have to be Catholic to be part of this great peace and social justice movement. Started, as Dorothy Day herself wrote, just sitting around at her kitchen table talking. Later in November, there's the National Day of Mourning. Every year on Thanksgiving Day in Plymouth, Massachusetts, Native Americans have what they call the National Day of Mourning, when the aforementioned genocide is observed. During this day-long event, there's Native American speakers and music, followed by a march through town, followed by a terrific meal in a hall with more speakers and music. I visited the National Day of Mourning for the first time last year and had the most meaningful Thanksgiving Day I can remember. The speakers make a very clear connection between the Western imperialism of 500 years ago and what's happening in the world today. The day after Thanksgiving, we have Buy Nothing Day. This is a nationwide campaign started by Adbusters, and it's pretty self-explanatory. For years, the day after Thanksgiving has been touted as the busiest shopping day of the year. People have recovered from the eating binge of the day before, and they set out to start their Christmas shopping. For those of us who take issue with the commercialism and consumerism of Christmas, Buy Nothing Day rings true. Buy Nothing Day sends a signal to corporations. Many people have been inspired by this day to simplify their entire holiday season. December 1st is Rosa Parks Day. It was on this day that Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus, thus breaking a racist, segregationist law and creating a watershed moment in the history not only of the U.S. civil rights movement, but also in the history of nonviolent civil disobedience. She broke an unjust law because doing so was less of a crime than the law itself. Thank you, Rosa Parks. December 10th is Human Rights Day. What a great concept, especially in this time when too many people define each other in black and white terms like good and evil. Let's focus on the rights that we all deserve. Rights that governments don't give us, but which those governments are compelled to recognize as our entitlements, that they should keep their hands off. And while we're exercising our right to free speech on Human Rights Day, let's push for making adequate health care, education, enough food and water, and a place to live inalienable human rights that are observed here in our country. December 21st is the winter solstice, an alternative New Year's Eve of sorts. Sure, we follow a calendar, and January marks the beginning of our new year, but somehow the solstice seems like a more intuitive beginning to a new year. Days start getting longer again. More daylight is good. So the past few years, I've been joining my pagan friends in welcoming in the new season on the winter solstice. Finally, for the month of January, we can go with one widely recognized holiday, observed even here in New Hampshire, finally, sort of, Martin Luther King Day. The term modern-day prophet sometimes gets thrown around too much, but Martin Luther King deserves that term. Too often, especially in mainstream media, all we get is a quick soundbite of King saying, "I have a dream." Do yourself a favor this Martin Luther King Day and read the entire I Have a Dream speech. King said so many timeless things about race, class, social justice, war and peace, God, the human spirit, and so many other topics. One Martin Luther King Day several years ago, I was in a town where a radio station broadcast all of King's speeches that had ever been recorded. King was so inspiring. Maybe our community radio station could broadcast his speeches this year. Whatever holidays you observe this season, I wish you the best. Let's celebrate in the spirit of bringing peace and justice to the world. For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson.
One of the events mentioned by Tom in the previous commentary is the National Day of Mourning gathering, which happens every year in Plymouth, Mass. On Thanksgiving Day. Last year, Tom went to the event and brought us the following coverage of it.
On Thanksgiving Day, many Native Americans and others gather at the top of Coles Hill, overlooking Plymouth Rock, for the National Day of Mourning. The first National Day of Mourning was held in 1970. The event includes Native American speakers, a march through the historic district of Plymouth, and a festive potluck social at a local church.
And I would also like to welcome you to Plymouth Rock. For those who haven't seen it, it's a very small rock down behind this thing here. And you better hurry up because the tide's coming in and it'll probably cover the rock. And we're here to correct a little bit of history, and I'm very briefly going to say something, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to one of the, one of the first people who was at the first National Day of Mourning in 1970. But before I do that, I'd just like to say one thing. This is not where the pilgrims landed. This rock was up in the middle of town in the middle 1800s, and it became a nuisance. And so somebody came up with the bright idea, why don't we move it down here, put 1620 on it, and we'll tell people this is where the pilgrims landed. Now, if they had landed on this rock for real, they would have had to have had the longest legs of any person who ever existed. This is a myth, just as we were talking about myths up on the hill. And it was Malcolm X who said, I believe that we did not land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that is the truth. So I'd like to turn the microphone over to Tara, who has a few words of greetings for you.
I want to tell you about the price of friendship. From the very first greedy determined footsteps of the invading Wanooksuk, or strangers on our land, there was one principal intention: to take it for their own by any means possible. Those greedy, calculated intentions have been all too well documented by 384 years of their presence here on our land, which they can never truly own, but will forever be trespasses upon it. This land is made from the dust and bones of our ancestors, who cry out with a vengeance to the disrespect of their intrusion and total ingratitude for our willingness to share what the Creator has given us. We did not go to the Wanooksuk. It was the Wanooksuk who came to us to feed off us as some predator or parasite. These pious hypocrites came with the Bible in hand and began the process of taking our land. When they came, they had the Bible, and we had the land. Now we have the Bible, and they have the land. God bless America. With so many of their people having been already eaten by the Spirit Eater, they transplanted here in our land the vulture culture they claimed to have fled from. A culture that fattened itself at the expense of others, based on complete insatiable greed, a greed that is documented every time I see another real estate or an obscene private property do not enter sign. What is truly real? What is truly real about the estate is that it was ours. Ever since the Creator put us here and gave us the gift of that land to respect and care for, as it continues to contain the dust and bones of our ancestors for all time. They repaid the kindness of Massasoit and our people by killing both of his sons and putting King Philip's head up on a pole here in this town, in front of the very same church where they prayed, quote unquote, the bullet through his heart, as a reminder of what would result from any resistance to their terror. God bless America. As these Indian killers evolved into slave traders, they continued to grow fat as we grew lean. As more and more of our dispossessed people, as well as their own, began to clutter up the towns they had built on our graves, they soon began to build poor houses so they could contain the misery and avoid having their eyes and their noses being offended by the sight. Becoming the fuel of the highly profitable slave trade, the New England rum, they could never produce fast enough, served another very important purpose as the Indian exterminator. It still continues as the completely legal drug to finish off the job begun with the torch and the gun, to help clear their title, quote unquote, to our real estate, robbing each Indian family of their fathers or mothers or sisters or brothers, even as I speak. My own father was a victim. God bless America. This insatiable greed for our land that began right here where we stand has never stopped. And my wife and all our future generations became its latest victims. On November the 5th, in the Massachusetts Land Court, where they fell victim to the economic and judicial terrorism that continues to eat away, vulture style, at whatever lands we may have retained. In spite of the 1665 deed of the original Mashpee Sachems to prevent such a thing, specifically stating it would belong to all future generations, quote, forever, and should never be given or sold or alienated without all their consent, unquote, this separation of Mashpee Indians from their lands took place without burning a single baby alive, or tearing a single child from our arms, or firing a single shot. Through much more perfected and sophisticated methods of executing their greed for our lands, this is all not only possible, but completely, quote, legal, unquote, so we're told. In these times, when we are bringing at the point of a gun freedom and justice to the people of Iraq. The, quote, legal, unquote, system itself has become the preferred weapon of mass destruction that is now used against us to exercise this continuing greed that never seems to die. As long as there remains a single tasty financial morsel on our financial bones to be picked. God bless America. The hierarchy of hypocrisy, which elevated the Pilgrims and the Puritans, America's first terrorists, to the level of some sort of sacred cow, has enabled some Euro-Americans to be so patriotic and venerate to a ridiculous level the flag, which drips with the blood of the native people.
Yeah.
Whose freedom was being denied as their own was proclaimed so loudly at the time of the nativity of that flag. To the Wenoksuk or strangers who came here, the flag is a unifying an essential symbol of the taking of Indian land as their own. Because it serves as the symbol of that adoption, it is venerated all the more by the more recent immigrants to our land, who are programmed to believe the more you wave it, the more American you can become. Especially if you learn to sing God Bless America. To Native Americans who know their history, the flag is the ultimate symbol of true terrorism, as our AIM brothers told us when they first came and buried the flag. We know all too well how the blood of our people was shed from sea to shining sea, as the American dream was constructed at our expense. The broad red stripes that flow from border to border symbolize all the blood of our people that had to flow from border to border as we became the roadkill of the Pilgrims' March of Progress. Singing God Bless America forever cannot remove the blood from that flag. A prayer offered or sung with denial and hypocrisy should never be expected to be answered. If present-day Americans really want God to truly bless America, there must first be an acknowledgement of all their past wrongs. And a sincere contrition for all that has been and continues to be done to destroy our people and our land. Only then can the much-needed blessing come to America. because there is a great and good creator who looks down and sees all things. The 500 years of denial of the terrorism that was unleashed on this continent by choice of the immigrant terrorists must be acknowledged if the consequences of those wrong choices are to ever cease. Every action has a reaction. From the most respected elder in my family, I learned all of man's problems come from going against the laws of the Creator and of His creation. The hurricanes, tornadoes, and all other natural disasters will continue to break all record-keeping records. Unspeakable horrors worse than 9-1-1 will take place as more and more of the world will come to hate America with even more intensity than they do now. Bombing the babies of Baghdad and slaughtering and crippling innocent Iraqi women and children and their fathers and brothers will not, I say will not, make America safer, but only... but only increase the frustrations and hatred of the witnesses to all these events of collateral damage, quote unquote. The psychological damage to the young U.S. military, who may be lucky enough not to come home to their families in a body bag, after doing what they have been trained to do, is still yet to be determined. Our prophecies have warned about all these things. God bless America. The ancient prophecies have told us that the many strange new diseases for which there is no cure, that came from the poisoning of our air and contamination of the sacred waters of life, will continue as we approach the period that is called the time of the nine hells, coming to an end in the year 2012, the year of the true millennium, on the sacred Mayan calendar, which is much more accurate than the European calendar. At this time, the almighty dollar will be worth nothing, as the self-destructive value system, of this society reaches its inevitable conclusion. Then the time of the 13 heavens will begin for the native people of this land, because there is a creator who sees all things. Nieyo, it is so.
A number of years ago, 1997, which I can't believe is 7 years ago, right on this street, right behind us, a number of United American Indians and our supporters were, for lack of a better word, attacked by the officialdom of Plymouth and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And some women and children and elders were pepper sprayed, thrown to the ground brutally. And 25 of us were arrested, and we spent that afternoon, instead of being at a social, we spent it in the brand new, I might add, Plymouth Police Station, where we were able to negotiate a settlement with the town of Plymouth. Basically, they realized that they were wrong, they had violated our rights, we did not need a permit to march on our own land. And because of that, we were able to negotiate a very nice settlement with the town of Plymouth, and the beautiful thing was is we didn't have to give up a thing, and they had to give up plenty. And the beauty of that settlement, the first part of it was we got a substantial sum of money to start a Native education project, the Medicom Education Project. Another part of that settlement was Plymouth had to erect, at their cost, two historical markers. Now, there was one on Coles Hill, where we started. That explains the National Day of Mourning. And there's one right here behind me. And this talks about Medicom, or King Philip. And this talks about the fact that after he was murdered, his head was displayed on a pole somewhere in this immediate vicinity for 25 years. And if you get a chance to walk by this, take a look at it and read it.
because this is actually probably one of only two historical markers in Plymouth that actually tells the truth. We don't talk about, you know, this pilgrim having built this home and so forth and so on. This tells the truth. And this was another part of our settlement. They had to erect this one and the other one down on Coles Hill. But above and beyond all of that, Plymouth basically had to admit that we have the right to hold National Day of Mourning at noon on U.S. Thanksgiving Day and to march through the streets of Plymouth without ever having to get permission from the town of Plymouth. We don't have to get a permit. We don't have to do anything but show up. And guess what? We've shown up, and we're going to continue to show up. I thank everybody who has come this year. I hope to see you next year. And bring a friend. Even though the social hall is small, we'll all get to eat this afternoon. So thank you, and I look forward to seeing you at the 36th National Day of Mourning.
And we also, we want to thank our brothers and sisters, our indigenous sisters and brothers that we never forget who come from Central and South America. Because we must remember we are one people, and we must remember the prophecy that when the condor and the eagle would be united, then our people would be able to be free.
People from all over come to this gathering. At this 35th National Day of Mourning, a few hundred people turned out, including a man from Peru dressed in traditional clothes of the Incas.
What brings him to the National Day of Mourning here today?
¿Qué le trae a este día de? He's relating that he belongs to a musical folk group called Inca Song. He comes from Peru, and he comes here representing the Incas of Peru, and he's coming on this day of mourning to try to keep the traditions and their beliefs that they have respect for the earth and the sun and
la tierra, dijo la tierra, el sol,
la luna, lo natural, la naturaleza,
and the moon, all nature.
Could he describe the traditional clothing that he's wearing?
Puede describir la el traje. He's wearing a representation of the dress that the Inca, who was the chief of this big group of natives that cover all the region of Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia and Chile.
This year's National Day of Mourning was dedicated to Leonard Peltier.
I know there's a few folks in the crowd who are asking who is Leonard Peltier, and you know what? We should have explained that in the rally, because we shouldn't assume that everybody knows who Leonard Peltier is. Leonard Peltier is an Anishinaabe man. He's a native man who was a member of the American Indian Movement. And he was framed up by the FBI back in 1976. The FBI said that Leonard had shot a couple of FBI agents. They said this and framed him up, even though their own ballistics and other evidence showed that Leonard did not shoot any FBI agents. They wanted somebody to pay for the crime of shooting two FBI agents on Pine Ridge Reservation. Even though they know, they knew then and they still know now that Leonard was not guilty, they insist on keeping him in prison. He has now been in prison for 10,519 days, I believe it is. He has been in prison since his children were young. He now has grandchildren. He is a symbol. Some of you may remember or may have heard of Nelson Mandela, who is a symbol to the world of the fight for justice of the people of South Africa. Leonard Peltier is a symbol to us and to the world of the fight for freedom and justice of the native people.
The entire prison in Leavenworth had been locked down until the day before yesterday. He was unable to communicate with the outside world. But we were fortunate enough to get a statement from Leonard. For the last few years, I have actually hoped that Leonard could be with us on this stage to give a statement. But it just hasn't come to pass. But we will keep fighting for his release.
our leaders followed the principles of truth, faith, and charity, and courage. In essence, this country should practice the principles of Thanksgiving and Christmas throughout the year, as well as the principles of freedom and equality that so many declare is the tradition of this government. So, should Thanksgiving Day of mourning come next year and find me gathering golden oak leaves as a free man, it will be because you didn't give up, because you stood for the principles I've mentioned, and because you demonstrated your commitment to truth, charity, and justice. I swear to you, I will put on a ceremony you will remember and tell your children and grandchildren about. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, your brother forever, Leonard Peltier, Detakius Okresen.
My name is Matawi Monroe. I'm co-leader of United American Indians of New England, and I used to work in Portsmouth years ago and live in Maine. Yeah.
And how long have you been working on organizing the National Day of Mourning?
I think I've been working on organizing it since about 1987, something like that. I don't know. I'm not counting.
And what was it that drove you to start doing that?
I had heard about National Day of Mourning for a number of years, and because I hadn't lived in New England before, had never attended, but when I moved to New England, that was one of the very first things I wanted to do, was to go to National Day of Mourning. And it really, to me, it is such a beautiful day. I love the strength and unity of it. I love all the people who come from, as we say, the four directions to stand in solidarity with us. I love being outside there at Plymouth Harbor and kind of thinking, just looking out over Plymouth Harbor and thinking about what the world really must have been like before the Europeans invaded and what it must have looked like. I think, to me, I think some people celebrate New Year's Eve. To me, National Day of Mourning is kind of a marker of each year and progress that we've made in the past year, that kind of thing. I love the voices of all the different Native people who come to speak about their struggles or what's on their mind.
I have a question about something that's probably maybe a little more difficult to talk about. As we were walking through town in the march, there was the woman who was yelling out the window. I don't know if you heard her. She kept saying, you know, 200 years, it was 200 years ago, what do you want, what do you want, things like that. And it's probably something that's heard, you know, fairly often at events like this. What would you say to a person like that?
I actually didn't hear her. I think some people, especially in Plymouth, which makes money off of this mythology and tourism accompanying it. I think some people don't want to part with their mythology, and some people want to believe that, you know, George Washington really didn't chop down really never did tell a lie, and all of that kind of garbage that they were taught in school, and they want to believe that the Pilgrims were wonderful people and were very fair to the Native people, and they want to believe that Columbus discovered America, and some people are just going to hang on to that kind of dangerous fantasy with every ounce in their body, I suppose. But I think more and more people don't want to hang on to that kind of thing and really do want to know the truth. I think for some people who say, well, that happened hundreds of years ago, what's the problem? Well, you know, we talk about contemporary issues. The problem is that our land, almost all of our land, has been stolen from us. The problem is that not one single treaty has been honored by the United States government. The problem is that Native people continue to live in the deepest poverty in this country and have very little access to decent health care. The problem is that racism against us is so deep and prevalent that people often don't even see it. We're almost invisible in the media. And when I know even, you know, I have young children, I don't even want them to watch a movie like Peter Pan, which many parents take for granted, but Peter Pan has these ugging things that are supposed to be Indians within the movie, and I don't want my children to think that that's what Indians are, because they know better. They know everything about Native people because they're growing up within their culture.
You're one of the main organizers of the National Day of Mourning. Can you talk about how you got involved in it in the first place?
Well, my father, Wamsutta, was one of the founders in 1970. And as he got older, of course, his health wouldn't allow him to keep coming up here to Plymouth and standing outside in the rain and the cold. So in 1994, he and the Council of Elders decided to turn the leadership over to me. And then I immediately turned it into a co-leadership thing with myself and Matoe Monroe, a man and a woman who speak equally, rather than having just one leader, if you will.
And how long have you been involved in the organizing of the event?
Well, I've been, this is my 10th year as a leader of the organization, but I had been here in the 70s. I was here the first day of morning when we boarded the Mayflower and tore the Union Jack down and replaced it with a flag that had flown over Alcatraz. I buried Plymouth Rock three or four times. So I go way back, but I haven't been here every year, you know, since this began.
I'm sorry, maybe could I get your name and just family background, ancestry?
Well, my name is Munanam, and I'm an Aquinnah Wampanoag.
I don't know if you noticed this person or not, but as we were marching through town, there was a woman yelling out of her window. And she was saying something about, you know, that was 200 years ago. You know, what do you people want or something like that? What do you say to a person like that?
Well, basically, we're here to get the truth out. I mean, it may have happened. Actually, it was longer ago than 200 years. She ought to read her history. But we're here to correct the history. I mean, yes, it happened 350 years ago, 385, I think, to be exact. But that doesn't necessarily mean that what happened is correct. And that we should just say, well, it happened, it's over, and it's done with, what can we do? You know, we still have to fight for equality in our own country.
All around the country right now, you know, there are people who are, you know, pigging out on lots of food and not thinking about these things at all. If there was a message that you could send to people who might tune into a show like this, what would you like to say?
Well, I think that what, you know, they should sit down and be grateful and thankful for what they have, but they can't forget that who they had to kill, who they had to murder in order to get that, and who they continue to kill and who they continue to murder in order for them to sit down and enjoy whatever it is they enjoy. It really boils down to that. Do I sound angry? Yes, of course I sound angry. Can I let bygones be bygones? No. I'm going to continue to struggle until I feel that all oppression is ended, until we live in a country where no one goes without, and until we live in a country where the rich don't get richer and the poor get poorer, to where we all have an equal footing. So I guess you could say, basically, until I see the absolute destruction of the system that I presently have to live under.
That actually sort of sparks one more question, if you don't mind. A lot of people make parallels to what, you know, the people who first came here from Western Europe and slaughtered so many Native Americans. And what's happening now in the Middle East, both with, you know, the U.S. invading and occupying Iraq, and also with what's happening to the Palestinians. Many, many people make that parallel that I've heard, that it's very similar. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think what we have to realize is, number one, the Middle East was carved up primarily after World War I. I mean, that's when Kuwait came into existence, and then after World War II, Israel came into existence. And they took Palestine to make Israel. So an indigenous population was totally dispossessed, thrown off their land, said, see you later, we'll put you out someplace where you can't grow anything, you can't do anything. And then Iraq was a sovereign country. It was absolutely no threat to the United States. And one thing I do know that hasn't come out yet is that when they did find weapons of mass destruction over there, but we didn't hear about them finding it because 95% of them said made in the USA. So, I mean, come on. What was the big deal? You know, we're over there, thousands of people have been wounded, maimed, whatever, and then a thousand or so have been killed for nothing except a little bit of oil. So Bush and his cronies with the Carlyle Group and all these groups can just get richer and richer and richer. And I'm sick and tired of sending our youth over to do that. And especially when, why don't these rich youth go over there? Why don't we ask the president, if you will, or excuse me, the first, I have to put this, appointed president of the United States, you know, why he didn't serve during Vietnam and how come he hid behind his daddy's coattails. So, you know, it's very easy to send somebody else's kid over, and I think it's time that that stops.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson.
For more information about the National Day of Mourning gathering this Thursday, November 24th, 2005, at Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts, 12 noon sharp, you can contact the United American Indians of New England at 617-232-5135 or UAINENDOM at earthlink.net.
In circles we gather, moonlight fires are kindled, sending it back. We just make it go back. Beating hearts, beating hearts, come as one, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian country. Together we dance, all of First Nation. There's no chance ever gonna give up. Beating hearts, come as one, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian country.
That was Robbie Robertson with Stomp Dance.